This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. And you don't know how lucky you are. Up until about an hour ago or so ago, I guess we were off the air having some problems, and we went out to Goose Bay, or somebody did and fixed it. So I'm happy to be on the air, and we'll, as you know, repeat again this evening. My guest today is Judy Narsegian, and we're going to be talking about some women's health issues, particularly those related to birth and pregnancy. Before I do, I want to follow up on the swine. The H1N1 flu problem. As we talked about last week, influenza is not just flu. Flu is a misconception or misrepresentation of the term flu, which we often use for any viral illness in this country. True influenza is a much more significant respiratory illness with significant fever, body aches, cough, congestion, some vomiting and diarrhea in some individuals. More importantly, it's significant enough illness that there's about 36,000 excess deaths each year attributed to influenza, mainly in individuals who are high risk, but also very young children at risk as well. Anyway, so a new influenza strain, which is not being covered with the vaccine that was distributed this year, is circulating. The good news is it does not seem to be as virulent, that is, as deadly as it could have been. We're not out of the woods yet. It's certainly being quite contagious. And as of 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time this morning, there were 36 states reporting individuals that documented with this illness, 286 cases, one death, and I think about 20 to 30 hospitalizations. It's still a significant problem, possibly. We don't know. It's evolving. It may even go away this spring and return next fall, and hopefully we'll, if that's the case, we'll have time to make an immunization. The recommendations are if you're sick, stay at home. Don't go spreading this kind of illness around. If you're not sick, take care of yourself. Wash your hands frequently after contact with individuals. Cover your mouth and face when you're sneezing and coughing. It does appear to be some evidence that masks can help promote or prevent the transmission of this illness. If you're really sick, having difficulty breathing, shortness of breath, and feel to be seriously ill, you should see a physician. It's not absolutely necessary to see a healthcare provider with the illness. However, it probably would make sense to call and talk them to your provider if you think you're ill. Go to cdc.gov, H1N1. It used to say swine flu, but that website has got more information, reliable information, than you would want. And we also got an FDA advisory this morning that there's a lot of hucksters selling you things that don't work for diagnosis and treatment, so be careful about buying things over the internet. There are medications that work, but they're only available by prescription. My guest today is Judy Narsegian. Judy is the executive director of an organization called Our Bodies, Ourselves. In addition, she's written, co-authored a number of books with that initial title. The most recent one deals with pregnancy and birth. She's up here to discuss some of the issues related to the book and to promote the book, and as well as a movie that's going to be this evening at the Beartooth that we'll discuss shortly. Judy, welcome to Line One.
Pleasure to join you, Thad.
It's really great to have someone of your stature here. You're around the country traveling a lot, doing some promotion. You've mentioned you want to talk a little bit about our healthcare system, so I hope we have time to do that as well.
Sure, and it's wonderful to be in such a beautiful state.
Well, you got lucky. this week is what we all wait for after the winter. All right, so tell us a little bit about the Boston Women's Health Book Collective and Our Bodies, Ourselves.
Sure. First of all, that is still our legal name, Boston Women's Health Book Collective, but we have a doing business as, and we now go by Our Bodies, Ourselves, since for nearly 40 years, that's what everyone called us anyway. So we're going with the flow. The organization is best known for the book Our Bodies, Ourselves, now in its eighth edition, came out in like 2005. And it was actually the first edition that was edited primarily by the next generation of women. A younger cadre of women were taking over the leadership in the organization. We have since published two single-topic books, one on menopause in 2006, and then last year, the most recent single-topic book was on pregnancy and birth. And these have given us the opportunity to focus in a more direct way on some of these issues that are really critical for women's lives at different points in their lifespan. And what's happened around the pregnancy and birthing issue is that we've met with providers and midwives and obstetricians and local support groups and those who have used services of a different sort and decided to become more prominent as advocates, reaching out to legislators, for example, to seek licensure and regulation of certified professional midwives, reach out to hospitals and to caregivers to expand and increase access to VBACs, vaginal births after cesareans. These are becoming extinct in some communities. And also to expand access to midwifery care in the hospital and birth center setting. These are primarily certified nurse midwives or certified midwives. And as we look around the world, we see that almost every other industrialized country, which has better outcomes in terms of birth, spends less money than we do. The big difference is they utilize midwives much more for the uncomplicated births, and that we need to see a sea change in this country whereby most uncomplicated births ultimately are attended by midwives who are the true experts in normal birthing with good collaborative relationships and backups with obstetricians and fetal maternal experts and family practice physicians who are also a mainstay in providing maternal and child health care in this country. So we're very eagerly involved in some of these debates. Right now, this very week, we've been supporting an effort to get a bill in Congress, which is about to be introduced by Susan Davis in California, that would call for Medicaid reimbursement of birth center facilities. It would require CMS, which provides Medicaid funding, to offer such reimbursement. It's the reason we need this legislation is that a judge in Texas recently made a very, I would say, uninformed ruling that called upon CMS not to reimburse the facility fee for such birth centers. So we have an immediate crisis on our hands, but I think it will get resolved. Most of the legislators I've spoken with are very supportive of this bill.
Okay. Before we move on, let's go ahead and discuss the very specific reason why you're here and what's going on tonight and how people can attend if they'd like.
Well, we're going to be seeing a very provocative and interesting film called Orgasmic Birth. And then we're going to have a discussion about many of the issues that couples confront as they approach the thought of becoming pregnant or they're pregnant, seeking caregivers. As they think about childbirth, what are the major issues? How do they, for example, avoid an unnecessary cesarean section? How do they seek out a caregiver that best matches their philosophical and ideological sort of concerns about birth? How do you, for example, deal with the fact we have a climate of fear and doubt in the United States? It's particularly unique to this country that women are being socialized to think so fearfully about birth and about the pain associated with labor. How do we address those problems? What kinds of things can we do to make women feel more confident, to make women realize there are things we can do about pain, that we don't have to go into the whole enterprise of birthing thinking it's going to be totally unbearable and inexplicably awful? There are approaches we can take that really build confidence and the ability of women to think much more positively and actually have an impact in terms of having a positive birthing experience.
We wanted to put this off a second, but I can't help but want to get into how this issue is just, to me, a microcosm of really what's going on in healthcare in this country. We are spending more than any other country. We're getting less for our money. And that's what you just said about the birth process.
Well, on April 3rd, we just had a major symposium in Washington, D.C., bringing together about 250 leaders, obstetricians, midwives, healthcare providers, professional liability experts, anyone involved in maternal and child health to look at some of the challenges we face in maternity care. One of the things that's clear front and center is that we have a perverse payment incentive system in terms of those who are practicing in the field being given more incentives financially to not necessarily do the right thing, the evidence-based thing, the thing that produces the best outcome, but the thing that will produce the best payment for the facility or the practitioner. I even was told a story about a facility that wanted to become baby-friendly, which meant, you know, stopping giving out the free formula samples, promoting breastfeeding much more aggressively, supporting women who choose to breastfeed. Now, it's interesting that about 85% of women want to breastfeed at the get-go. And when they get to the hospital, many of the institutional practices are not conducive. This was actually just discussed in a recent article published in a major medical journal. So we have a challenge here. Well, what happened in one facility is that a pediatrician who was basically bringing this up and noting that the NICU population, the neonatal intensive care unit, would have fewer babies as a result of promoting breastfeeding, because we know that from certainly plenty of data around the country, the response was, well, that's not such a good thing because our NICU bills for umpteen amount of dollars in procedures a year, it's a major source of revenue for us. And I'm not so sure I'm so happy about reducing the NICU population. Now, one facility I know in Boston, when the CEO was told this by a particular member of the hospital staff, said, now, isn't that a good problem? I like that problem. We're going to find other sources of revenue. We're not going to seek out an increased population in our NICU. I'm happy that we're going to see fewer babies in distress. So if we had a different system, we wouldn't see this as emerging as nonsensical response to what would be improved outcomes. If we had, for example, a single-payer system where we provided care that was evidence-based, where we didn't have financial incentives, we didn't have, you know, payment for procedures, or we didn't provide physicians with more money if they did a cesarean versus if they were a vaginal birth. If we did, we created a system that had much more common sense reimbursement policies, we would see a lot of this just disappear. We wouldn't see a C-section rate that is now at 40% and 50% in many of our major teaching hospitals. This is not good for mothers or babies. And we know that. We've got plenty of data on this, that one of the reasons that we're seeing this phenomenon is, of course, the liability climate. Many physicians are rightfully concerned about the remote but nonetheless statistical possibility that they would be sued for not having intervened, not having done something that they themselves thought was unnecessary, but they had to cover themselves. And in some cases, they recommended a cesarean because if something should go wrong with a vaginal birth, they might be sued as a result. These are things that wouldn't be a concern if we didn't have the professional liability system we have right now, if doctors didn't have to worry about astronomical fees for getting malpractice coverage, if we could resolve those problems as they have been in some other countries.
I could talk about this all day, but maybe we'll come back to it in a second, but I don't want to forget to talk about where the program is tonight. Beartooth Restaurant, 5:30 is the movie is going to be on and lasts an hour, hour and a half, and then there's a discussion afterwards. And
that's right.
Everybody's invited who wants to come.
And anybody can ask whatever question he or she wants. We can talk about, you know, nitrous oxide during, you know, labor and what kind of pain management women need, all those kinds of things.
All right, 5:30 tonight, Beartooth. You're welcome. You're invited. It's a movie about some of our childbirth experiences or what's going on, and then a discussion about where we are and how we got there and what we might be able to do about maybe making some rational changes in this process. Okay. So talk about your book.
Well, I'll tell you something interesting. It was not our idea to pick this as one of the first two single topics. It actually came from the editors and the female staff at Simon & Schuster. At that point, they were reading something called What to Expect When You're Expecting, a book which has since improved. But when they first read it, they were horrified because it was fear-mongering of the worst sort. And they said, this is what everyone's reading, at least around New York City. And we want to see a different book that's evidence-based, that's much more reasonable in its tone. And although there are some good books out there in the childbirth arena, none of them had gotten that much attention. And because our bodies are cells, it's got such a widely respected name, they felt that we should do a single-topic book. So we embarked upon this proposition with help from about 140 obstetrician, midwives, schools of public health, experts in the field, researchers, and women who have given birth, women who are pregnant, women who are thinking about pregnancy, because we always believe that the sum total of everybody's contribution here, whether you're a woman who is going to have a baby, whether you're a practitioner, whether you're someone who's running a hospital, that everybody's contribution is important. So we decided to create a book that would deal with this question of a climate of fear, climate of doubt, that would bring in all the evidence-based literature we have, and we have a fair amount in the childbearing field, that we would deal with the questions of how do you choose a provider, how do you choose a place of birth. We would bring in the literature. We wouldn't allow for somebody to be, you know, told something that was simply not true, that out-of-hospital birth is unsafe. The truth is that you pick your risks, and there are some risks to being in a hospital. You're much more likely to contract a serious infection, including those antibiotic-resistant ones, particularly if you have an operative delivery, a cesarean. MRSA infections are epidemic in some hospitals in this country. Well, there are a lot of reasons to think about not being in a hospital. If we have a pandemic flu, women are not going to be allowed to go to hospitals. They need birth centers, or they'll need home birth options because they simply won't want to be in a hospital. That's the worst place of all. So what we did is we laid out the evidence we've got on various options in hospital, hospital, out of hospital. We also included a great deal of material about the various caregivers, the midwives, the family practice physicians, and the obstetricians. And then we allow the reader, through the stories that both caregivers and women who had had babies share, and all of our books, a hallmark of all of our books, is that we, throughout the text, include the experiences and the thoughts and feelings and recommendations of people who've lived through the medical condition. In this case, it's all about birth and pregnancy. So we make sure you hear the voices and the stories of women and their partners, not just women. And we did that with a lot of help from our friends, and we followed, you know, the pregnancy birthing experience, and then we have a good section on postpartum about the importance of support for breastfeeding and about the importance of dealing with postpartum depression, recognizing it, recognizing that not necessarily appropriate to use drugs in a way that we are beginning to, in a, I think, almost cavalier fashion, that there are lots of ways to support women who are dealing with depression during pregnancy, postpartum. And then, of course, we talk about reforming the maternity care system. And our last two chapters, like many of our chapters in our other books, deal with advocating for change. And women in those chapters tell the stories of advocating in their own communities. One woman in Maryland restored the VBAC option in her hospital after there was a picket outside the hospital, and they even went to, you know, Today Show and USA Today, and they made it a cause that we need to have this as an option for women who want to have a subsequent birth that's not a cesarean section. And then we had the story of a woman who started a breast milk bank for the women in her community, women who started breastfeeding support groups. And in these cases, women put their names and faces to the work they did. In many of our earlier books, women gave their stories anonymously. But the need for anonymity is changing radically. If you just look at the internet, you'll see that. Many of the women in our book, in this book in particular, kept their name, kept their organizations, kept their personal stories because they're advocates as a result of their personal experiences.
Let me before we go on, just give some phone numbers. If anyone who is listening today has questions or comments about what you're hearing, you can reach us directly at 550-8433. That's in the next 45 minutes or so, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email me between now and just before 3 o'clock at line 1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at KSK.org. And remember, the program repeats tonight on a tape rebroadcast at 8 o'clock, and you can also go to ksk.org/line1 at any time and listen or refer people to this podcast so you can hear it again or have someone do that for you. So we've gotten into a situation in this country, if I can paraphrase you right, correctly, where there's a culture of worry about deliveries, which is leading to a change in how deliveries and birth is being done, and it's probably somehow related to our how we're incenting professionals in this healthcare system, all of which makes sense to me.
And I probably should correct something I said earlier, though I am a big single-payer fan. The truth is, if we had a true public option side-by-side with private payers, and we instituted that option in a way that reflected the values and the policies of organizations like Group Health in Seattle or even some of the Kaiser Permanente facilities in the Northwest and in California, you can see some of the same changes that we'd like to see in the larger system. When I was in Seattle, the Group Health folks were telling me about a 12% cesarean rate. That includes all their high-risk women as well. But they have a lot of midwives. They also have physicians who practice in a closed panel model. They are all paid by salary. Yeah. What they want to do is the best thing by every woman. Their salary isn't affected by what kind of birth a woman has. You see this in closed panel HMOs around the country. When you see them when they were truly there, there are very few left now. We also saw examples of cities where midwifery services were prominent in a hospital in one place but not in another. In my own city, I was born and brought up in the Boston area. We are one of the medical meccas of the country. We have several very large teaching hospitals with substantial nurse midwifery services. And in those hospitals, our cesarean rate with a lot of high-risk women is somewhere around 30-32%. If you go to the one teaching hospital that doesn't have midwives now, the cesarean rate is above 40%. There's no difference in the population of women who use these facilities. And that tells you right then and there that utilizing midwives to do a greater proportion of uncomplicated births will lead to lower cesarean rates right then and there. You don't have to have single payer for that to happen. You have to have more midwives. So we could say, no matter what we do with healthcare reform, let's include much more federal funding for the training of midwives so that we can have more midwives in the pipeline, support the preceptors, the professors, the people who teach midwives right now. They're under a great deal of personal strain. They're asked to do a lot of training for very little compensation. If we change that picture, we could then see gradually reconfiguration of the human power, the caregivers that we assign to the role of attending women who are giving birth.
Okay. Judy, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Line 1, your health connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center.
This is Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host. Today we're talking with Judy Narsegian, and we're talking about women's health issues, and particularly birth and pregnancy. Judy, let's talk specifically about some of the aspects of our current way of dealing with birth that are specifically problematic for you. And perhaps we can rediscuss how we got to that point. I'm thinking about C-sections and VBACs, which you've mentioned, and pain relief and those kinds of things.
Well, right now, because of this climate of fear, many women express as their primary concern that giving birth will be too painful, so that they're some of them misguidingly saying, I think maybe I want a cesarean so I don't have to go through the experience of giving birth. Well, of course, those women haven't thought about how much pain is involved in recovery, and it isn't just immediate postpartum. There are also scar adhesions. There's a lot of pain to be experienced even decades after a cesarean, as women have described, problems from recovering from cesareans. It's not everybody, but it's a significant minority. There's also some of the other problems you have, like infection. Babies have higher rates of respiratory distress. Women have more problems with infection. And there are some very large studies that have looked at this and shown that for the woman, it's definitely a higher risk to do a cesarean, and even for babies in some sense. So what we need to do is figure out a way that women are not thinking about cesarean as a solution to this idea of it's going to be too painful. They're also thinking, well, I'll have an epidural, which is considered sort of the standard of dealing with pain during labor. Now, we know that epidurals can be a very effective and sometimes a very satisfying way to deal with pain during labor, but there are problems. There are downsides. We talk about these in the book. There's also a way in which some of the natural hormones are inhibited by epidural administration, and that certain things don't happen in labor that might otherwise happen. Well, what could we offer women who are fearful about the pain of labor being a little bit more than they could handle? Well, all over the industrialized world, women have nitrous oxide. It's something called laughing gas. Sometimes you get it in the dentist's office. It turns out it's not perfect pain management, but as women all over the world have said, it's pain management that's good enough. And there are several hospitals in the United States who routinely make it available. Some of the larger studies have been done at the University of California in San Francisco by the person who teaches anesthesiology residents there, Dr. Mark Rosen. And we decided to include a sidebar in our book because this is an extremely important issue for women. And it is something that is administered by the woman. You can't overdose. It provides immediate and short-term relief. May not be total, but it's enough to get you through that really tough contraction. And many women find that just using it episodically during their labor is all they need. Then when the moment comes to push, unlike a fairly substantial minority of women who are given epidurals and they're told to push, they don't feel, they don't know what you mean, they can't feel to push, you can always feel to push. So you don't get that obstacle at the end when you're ready to push. I want to mention that there's another book out, newer than ours, by a wonderful pediatrician, Dr. Mark Sloan from Kaiser Permanente, actually. He's in the Santa Rosa area in California, in which he spends 10 pages talking about nitrous oxide. Mm-hmm. And as he did his book called Birthday, he had no intention of writing about this till he did more research. And he was fascinated by the fact that it went out of fashion in a way that didn't made no sense to him. So we're hoping that all the discussion about nitrous oxide is reintroduced. We have a very extensive and technical blog discussion, including some objections from an anesthesiologist in Chicago, our answers, and those who are interested should go to ourbodiesourblog.org and simply pick up on this thread of a very intense discussion about nitrous oxide, and we're hoping that we'll be part of the advocacy effort to reintroduce nitrous oxide in this country.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Today we're talking with Judy Narsegian, who is the executive director of Our Bodies, Ourselves, and has been involved in several books written with that initial title. The most recent one is also in dealing with pregnancy and birth. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear today, call us at 550-8433, 550-8433, or email me directly at lineone@kska.org. You know, we hear a lot about the mind-body connection. Everybody talks about it, but we forget that it also has an impact on what you're talking about, in that we now, as you said, I think probably correctly, have a culture where we think there is going to be a lot of pain and a lot of discomfort, and women used to go through this without any problems. And I remember when it was a 5-day after that famous C-section we're talking about before you got home to the hospital, and 3 days for a delivery, and now it's pretty standard. You rarely see women more than 3 days in the hospital. So what our perception is and what our expectations are often come to be, and we've changed those.
And the fact is that women have an enormous range of experiences here, and this is in the range of normal. There are women like myself who had a 2-day labor. I had no medications. It was long. I was up 2 nights, kind of, getting tired. but it wasn't terribly painful. It was an enormously satisfying experience, and my husband cut the cord. It was just a fabulous experience. There are other women who have much more distressing experiences. One of the things I've learned in my decades of talking to women is that the best support you can get is crucial for making it through your labor and your birth. And that's why having doulas, having good labor support, utilizing midwifery care if you've got it. Many communities in this country don't have a midwife, so that's not an option for many women, even if they'd want it. In many hospitals, they have what we call a model of co-management, where physicians and midwives and sometimes family practice physicians train together and work together. And women might come in and be seen by a midwife or a family practice physician, but a teen cares for her. And in the end, she'll have met several people. And, you know, you're not always sure who's going to be at your birth when the birth happens. But you want to make sure you feel confident about their philosophy. It matches yours. And that's the key thing here, is that you find someone you're comfortable with. We also really have to admit that because of the way medicine is practiced in most maternity care departments today in this country, and there's a lot of defensive medicine practice, there are very high rates of unnecessary medical interventions, sometimes with a cascade of responses and need for other interventions that lead to outcomes like unnecessary cesareans, other problems that we could avoid. There's another phenomenon, which is that we've seen an increase in medically unindicated inductions. Sometimes women mistakenly think it's perfectly fine, 37, 38 weeks, I can just schedule it with the physician I want. Physicians don't disabuse them of the fact that we know now that many of those babies at 37, 38 weeks, late premature, their late-term premature babies will have problems. Some of them will end up in a neonatal intensive care unit. There are a few hospitals I know where they have now a standing rule, which is that nobody does a medically unindicated induction until 39 weeks. You know, then it's pretty much you're close to term. They don't have any evidence that that's going to cause a problem. Well, when you start inducing in these earlier points, you have higher rates of cesarean section. But the most important thing is you have higher rates of prematurity and low birth weight babies. Some of this is because the dating is not perfect sometimes, that we think we have a 37 or 38-week pregnancy and we're really off by a week or so. Mm-hmm. But it does make sense for women to be much more cautious about this, even if their caregivers aren't. Some women think, oh, I can have an elective cesarean. It'll be just as fine as having a planned vaginal birth, which might end up in a cesarean if it's needed. We need to have better education of women that this is not all in the same thing.
How about going about and choosing a provider? I think you addressed that at some length in how you go about making those decisions.
Well, if reducing unnecessary medical interventions is your goal and it's a value you have, for lots of reasons, they could be philosophical, they could be religious, they could be simply wanting to avoid some of the hospital-based problems that can occur, then you want to get a caregiver who has very low rates of intervention. Sometimes there are obstetricians who have this characteristic, generally not. Mostly they're family practice physicians and midwives. You have to find them, and sometimes it's word of mouth. It's not something you can easily find out by knocking on the door of the hospital. If you have a freestanding birth center in your area, and I know that you have one in Anchorage, maybe you have two in Anchorage. I'm not that well apprised of the options here, but you then can have a freestanding birth center approach using a midwife and have a hospital right nearby if you need to be transferred. So you have the best of both worlds. You can avoid unnecessary medical interventions, but if you need them, you're right there and can be transferred. The truth is there are very few true five-minute emergencies. If you're watching and you see the signs of a problem, you have time to transfer a woman and her baby who might be in distress and need of medical interventions that only a hospital can provide. And a very good midwife, a very good out-of-hospital childbirth provider can make sure you get that transfer done.
You know, it seems like if the argument is it's safer in the hospital, then we ought to be able to document that difficult problems related to childbirth in the hospital are going down in percentage and so forth. And I don't think that's necessarily – I mean, we have one of the highest rates in Western medicine of problems is my understanding.
Yes, but if you take the biggest issue, which is infant – you know, neonatal mortality and, right. and basically does a baby die at birth mm-hmm. – you're not going to see a difference. The CPM 2000 study, a recent huge study of, 30, 40, 50,000 births. I forget the exact number from the Netherlands. A study that's coming out in Vancouver from British Columbia. But the big one, which is the one that was published in the BMJ, the CPM 2000 study, these studies all show there's no difference in mortality.
Okay.
There are differences in morbidity, mostly favoring an out-of-hospital birth, the numbers of interventions and some of the morbidity that ensues. But In terms of the big ticket items, you don't see a big difference. It's not that you're much more likely to have a baby die. And we have to recognize that childbirth is not a totally predictable thing. And it doesn't matter where you give birth. You might lose a baby. You might lose a mother. Even though we have good maternal mortality statistics overall, they're poor for African American women. We have enormous disparities in terms of race and even ethnicity, but particularly with African American women. We've got to go a long distance in repairing that. When I was in Dallas, just to give you an example of how we can't protect against maternal deaths as well as infant deaths, a beloved obstetrician died on the operating table with three of her colleagues around her. She was having, I think, her third baby, maybe her third repeat cesarean. It was either her third or fourth child. And she had something called placenta accreta. When the placenta embeds in the wall of the uterus, in this case the bladder too, you can have massive hemorrhaging, and no amount of medical intervention can save you from that. Now, we know that although the first-time cesarean section is largely, you know, all else being equal, reasonably safe thing to have happen, with each subsequent cesarean, we see an increase in some of these other more serious problems. There are low-level effects, I should say, you know, small percentages. But as we see more and more women having repeat cesareans, you're going to see more and more women having things like placenta accreta, which are life-threatening. So some obstetricians told me they used to see 1 to 2 accretas a year. They see 1 to 2 a month now. Some of those women, a small percentage, but some of them are not going to make it. And this is the kind of thing we can avoid if we are more prudent, more pragmatic. We avoid unnecessary interventions at the get-go.
With managed care in the way I thought it was going to evolve, and that term is not really carries a very good connotation now, but I saw it as we were going to monitor what's happening and give feedback to providers so that they would move towards the mean, which is what human nature does. And I remember one of the examples was cesarean sections, and that in a truly well-managed care, you could get C-sections down around 12%, I think is what you're saying. And then the costs and complications start going up. What's our national C-section rate now? And you might want to comment again about in truly managed organizations where physicians are employed, there's a different approach than the general private sector. What's the C-section rates in those?
Well, the national rate is above 32% now. It's probably a 1 in 3, and we just haven't measured it yet. But it varies enormously by the location. If you go to the University of New Mexico Teaching Hospital in Albuquerque, their cesarean rate with all the most complicated births in the state, in many cases, is about 22-23%. If you go to some of the birth centers that I've been in touch with and some of the hospital-based midwifery services that I'm familiar with, you'll get anywhere from a 6-13% cesarean rate. If you take just uncomplicated pregnancies, not the high-risk pregnancies, but the uncomplicated pregnancies attended by obstetricians, you will see a much higher rate of cesarean section. Now, the problem we saw with managed care is that for-profit managed care entered the picture. And so their goal is maximizing the returns for their shareholders. It's not improving and making sure that you got the best outcomes. When Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare, we used to be called Harvard Community Health Plan back in the greater Boston area, was run much like group health, we had this kind of really good outcome. We weren't denying women care. We weren't kicking women out of the hospital. We weren't doing any of the things that you saw the newspapers and the talk shows, you know, railing against, the sort of what I would call for-profit managed care model that was about denying care because they wanted to make profits for their shareholders. If you have a true not-for-profit, closed-panel system where caregivers are paid salaries, you don't see the problems you've had. In fact, the HMO I was part of never denied women care. You know, but they were really careful about evidence-based care. They watched themselves, and they said, listen, we as practitioners have to do what's best for women, what produces the best outcomes, and best for men, too, if you're providing care for everybody. And what we saw is that care was more judiciously offered. It wasn't that you were rationing care in any Malthusian, you know, crazy fashion. And that we've got to see return to the system as a whole. And that's one of the reasons why a public option is so important and why we can't let this ruse of private payers running a system where there might be public subsidy of the private payer option. People are moving towards something more like the Massachusetts model. Well, I can tell you, I come from Massachusetts. It's failing abysmally. Mm-hmm. We cannot pay the price tag. It is too expensive. It's fourfold what we expected it to be. And we're not providing care for all the citizens of Massachusetts. We've got to do something to control costs, even as we want a model of care that's evidence-based. And that's why I'm so glad that President Obama has introduced, you know, comparative effectiveness. We're plowing $1 billion into looking at what kinds of medical care gives us our best outcomes. I want to see some of this go into the maternity care area. I want to see more closer scrutiny of the midwifery model, and I want to see movement in that field as well.
All right. I'll ask one more question on the healthcare issue, then I'll try to stay off of it. But do you really think we can move in that direction where we're really trying to take the inappropriate incentives out of healthcare without going to a more single-payer system?
Well, it could be done, but we would have to have controls of the sort that many providers are not used to. Just remember, Kaiser Permanente is in a different system. Obviously, they are run differently. I'd like to see more of are running that way. The other thing I want to point out is that in some of these other countries that do better than we do, some of the care is for profit, the provision of care, but the insurance is social insurance.
Right.
None of it is for profit insurance. Mm-hmm. And I think much of the American public doesn't appreciate this. You may know that T.R. Reid, the famous Washington Post columnist, did this healthcare around the world special for PBS, and he was then asked to do healthcare around America, a similar documentary. And unfortunately, his bottom line conclusion was you can't have for-profit insurance and have it work if you simply take the lessons learned from what he saw around this country as well as what he learned from other countries. They decided to take out everything he said about this and instead put in somebody from the Association of Health Insurance Providers, I forget her name, and include some language that he felt was very misleading, and he had to actually pull himself out of the documentary. He doesn't appear in it now. Mm. So PBS decided to go another route to basically, mislead the American public. Nothing they said was actually false. But, you know, it's very important how you tell a story.
You don't have to tell the whole story either.
But, you know, and so there he is, a prize-winning journalist who did all this important work traveling around the world, you know, covered healthcare delivery in 5 continents. And some of these leaders in other countries have been interviewed in, you know, on the internet and some articles that are not in mainstream newspapers saying, you know, that's your problem here. You know, you've got to get social insurance even if you have a few for-profit providers, and that's not the direction you're moving in. We need to have a real debate about single-payer, even if we end up with side-by-side models. And right now, most members of Congress are not even willing to give it a fair shake. Right. And though we have 65 to 70% of physicians in this country endorsing single-payer, though we have the second largest medical specialty organization, the American College of Physicians, the biggest after the AMA, endorsing single payer 2 Decembers ago with a resolution. Most media have not covered this news. Most Americans don't know that physicians overwhelmingly support single payer. And in fact, Americans do too. When you ask them this question in all the surveys, it's somewhere between 55 and 60%. It's not that we're stupid. It's that we have legislators who get a lot of support and funding from the insurance industry, and they're loath to bite the hand that feeds them. It always boils down to that, unfortunately.
You're listening to Line One. If you've got questions or comments about pregnancy and delivery and how it's done in the United States or things you've heard today, let me give you a phone number, 550-8433, and you can express your opinion or give us your thoughts, 550-8433, toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and you can email at lineone, lineone at ksk.org. We did get one email, and it's from a lady who says that things were different back in the 70s. I guess when she had babies, there was no medications. They used focal points to stare at during labor to control pain. They went home with their babies and breastfed them. So has it been since the 70s that this change has come about, do you think? I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, even back in the 50s when I was born, mothers were not breastfeeding, as I recall. So, I mean, things change.
Well, breastfeeding certainly increased. But back in the 70s, there were spinals. There were other forms of anesthetic and analgesia offered. It's not that women never had pain medication. Before that, we had scopolamine, you know, the awful drug they gave women that made them hallucinate. We've always had approaches that one could use. And by the way, there are many things we've studied now that are effective. You can get into a tub. You can use water to deal with, say, you know, tough back labor. I saw this with my own eyes with births in my own family and friends. Women got into a tub and they found that their labor just eased up, the pain just eased up just like that. Sometimes women find massage helpful. Lots of things can help out, as adequate support is critical during labor. But it's also true that some women do need meds. They want the meds, and there's no reason they should be denied these meds if that's what they want, especially if they're getting good support and the trials of labor just prove to be more than they can handle. I think that we have the sea change really is around what's happening in obstetrical practice. You know, midwives have been doing a great job all along. The trouble is the model of childbearing has become much more medicalized, and the climate of, you know, worrying about liability, all of the lawsuits, the way in which the perverse payment incentives, as I mentioned earlier, play a role. These are things that have come into play. And, you know, we're really quite upset that much of what's out there doesn't inform women adequately in the beginning. One of the people who gave our book a very wonderful endorsement, Dr. Timothy Johnson, who heads up the OBGYN department and the teaching of residents at the University of Michigan residency program, the medical school there. He wrote a letter describing why they bought 4,000 copies of the book for every woman coming in for prenatal care in their hospital system, because it was evidence-based, because it said everything you needed to know in one book, and because, of course, when you buy in bulk, you can get the book for something like $7 and change, which he figured out after all the booklets they were buying, it was cheaper for the hospital. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I happen to know Dr. Johnson, and I know that, for example, he doesn't personally support the option of home birth, but he also supports women's autonomy and reproductive autonomy, and he recognizes the literature on this. So it's very interesting that there are obstetricians who personally don't support things like home birth, but they would never deny a woman the right to choose something that's a reasonable choice.
And I would suspect, getting back to something you'd said earlier, which we've talked about on this program, is, you know, if you really sit down and have an honest discussion with a pregnant woman or with yourself, what's the risks and what's the benefits? There is no risk. You got to start with that. There's always some risk. But when you look at it like that, then you begin to wonder what's going on in our system, because it gets changed by the incentives, as you've implied. But it really is, what's the risk of doing this and what's the risk of not? And there are risks going into the hospital.
There are. And even if you have somebody
who's risk not to be there too, but
supporting you the whole way and giving you the kind of environment you want, labor and birth, ultimately unpredictable. Things can go wrong. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter where you are. Unhappy things happen, and that's why I'm not such a big fan of birth plans, where people kind of get wed to the every little line on their birth plan, thinking it's got to go this way or else it's a bad experience. Women can have a cesarean section, and it could be a good experience. Mm-hmm. If it's a needed cesarean, if you recognize that's what needed to happen, you get good support from your caregivers, you don't have to feel bad about having had a cesarean. And I certainly know many women who've had good cesarean experiences. It's the women who feel that they were forced into it. And we have some good national surveys, the Listening to Mother surveys conducted by Harris Interactive Pulse for the Childbirth Connection and Lamaze International. It's a very important survey for people to read, because many women do feel like they were pushed into experiences and pushed into having interventions that weren't in retrospect necessary or needed. It's certainly, you know, I just got told a story of, you know, about a woman who was told she was going to have a cesarean because her labor wasn't progressing, the baby wasn't distressed, and the obstetrician did not propose breaking the waters, which is something you routinely routinely done by physicians and nurses everywhere. That often gets labor going. The woman can have a vaginal birth. She needed to get someone else to help her avoid the cesarean, which this physician was just about to schedule, even though he knew she did not want to have a cesarean. And she knew that breaking her waters could be a likely route to a successful vaginal birth, which it was. So those are sometimes obstacles women face when a caregiver isn't responsive to her values, her needs, and actually to good medical practice, too.
We have another email. It's got two questions, somewhat maybe peripheral, but I thought I'd see whether you want to handle these or not. It says, please discuss whether teen pregnancies are considered high risk by the medical community, that is 13 to 16-year-old teens. And then there's another question. We'll hit that one first. Do you feel okay with that?
Sure. I think many in the field do consider teen pregnancies high risk, but a lot depends on, you know, the circumstances of the pregnancy, how young is the girl. Sometimes these girls are not even fully through puberty. Sometimes the socioeconomic situation is very problematic. They're at risk for a lot of psychosocial problems. So, yes, in general, that is considered the case. That said, many teenagers I know is just in a facility in Dallas last year, Parkland, which does 13,000 births a year. They have many teenagers coming in. Many of them have totally normal vaginal births. They get plenty of support. They're usually attended by the midwives, who are really good with teens, and they have uncomplicated birth experiences. Now, when they leave the hospital, sometimes they have complicated home situations. And so support after the birth is so important, sometimes just as important, if not more important, than what happens in the hospital setting.
That's why your next book should be Our Bodies, Ourselves, Parenting.
We did that book.
Well, did you?
We did.
Oh,
it was
sorry.
Called Ourselves and Our Children in 1978, I think it was.
I'm too young. I didn't. All right. Another question is, please discuss the myth still floating around that abortions contribute to breast cancer.
Well, I thought we killed that one.
Okay.
We spent several hundred thousand dollars of our wonderful, valuable taxpayer money to have an NIH meeting that National Cancer Institute's held. And many people were angry that we were spending the money to do this, but it was during one of the conservative administrations who did this for political reasons. No, that one has been dealt with.
Not true.
Having abortions doesn't cause breast cancer.
Okay. And we have a caller. Harvey, you're on line one.
Thanks. I've got a question. You spoke earlier about the need for legislation to move birthing centers forward in terms of Medicaid. One of the other things that you might consider also, where the government spends a lot of money on health care, is in terms of TRICARE and the military health system. And that's something where my wife's pregnant right now, and we're finding it very difficult to sort of use the military health care system to have the sort of home birth or birth center birth that she's looking to have.
You're raising a very important point, and I want to point out that there's great variability in the military in terms of access to freestanding birth centers or even home birth providers. There are some places, and these births get funded by the U.S. government, where the obstetrical leadership, and the very few, I might say, are forward-thinking on this issue. You, however, can go to British Columbia. No.
To a birth center.
You can go to a birth center. That's true. You can go to a birth center here. You must have a certified nurse midwife attend you, and it will be covered.
We're not going to still be here for the birth. So we're going to end up moving to a state where the TRICARE system is broken up into the three different TRICARE subsidiaries, and it very much depends on where you are.
Oh, that's
and
true.
Unfortunately, we won't still be in Anchorage when it comes time for the birth.
Well, you know what? This is something we can't answer right on the radio now, but if you go to our website and find my email address, I can link you up with someone that can help you. It depends on where you are. There are options for those in the military to have birth center births, and they are in several places. This is also one of the things that we do want to see change, so that routinely midwifery care will be an option. And if you have a hospital-based midwifery service doing real midwifery care, it will be less significant that you don't have a birth center in the area. One of the reasons people are desperate to go out of hospital is that in the hospital they don't have a real midwifery service. So we are going to work on those issues, and and we'd love to maybe be in touch with you offline about it.
So it's okay. Our Bodies, Ourselves, all linked together.org, or you can go to our website, and we have a link there as well, Harvey.
Thank you.
We're getting down to where we just have a couple of minutes. You're going to be again tonight talking about or showing a movie and having a discussion. Starts at 5:30 at the Beartooth. I want to remind everybody about that. Another issue we haven't talked about is fetal monitoring, comments about fetal monitoring and where that's good and bad.
Well, in the eyes of many in the maternity care field, the introduction of routine fetal monitoring was probably the single most important change that started the C-section rate on its rise, inexorable rise, I might point out. You know, in the 70s, we had like a 5-7% cesarean section rate. Now we're up above 50% in many hospitals in this country. The national rate, as we said earlier, is about 1 in 3. Fetal monitors used routinely were studied after they became the standard of care. And the story of how they became the standard of care is, again, one about money and investments. The physician who was pushing it had actually private investments in the company that was marketing them. But ultimately, there was a very large trial, including 25,000 births or so, done by Dr. Albert Haverkamp at Beth Israel Hospital in the Boston area. And this study demonstrated that routine internal fetal heart monitoring did not produce any demonstrable benefits, except for maybe a small percentage of high-risk babies. Unfortunately, it had already become the standard of care, and it was very hard to turn the ship around. But what makes most sense for women is to have external auscultation with a fetoscope, and you can do that, you know, you can even do it in a hospital. And there are some hospitals that don't use routine internal fetal heart monitors, but most do. And this is now considered sort of a liability issue. This is why I would hope the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists could take a leadership role, and they could point to the evidence and say, you know, we really don't need to call this something that needs to be the standard of care, because it has led to lots of false positives where you think a baby's in distress, it's not really in distress, then you intervene and you produce this cascade of effects. And one of the problems we have to point out here is that we're talking about continuous internal fetal heart monitoring. Mm-hmm. If you check periodically, that's not as bad. But if you have continuous internal fetal heart monitoring, the woman has to stay usually in the bed. She doesn't get up and move around, which is very important during labor. She doesn't have mobility, which is important during labor. And it interferes with the process of labor in a way that is separate from, you know, monitoring whether the baby's doing okay here, here and there.
So the evidence suggests that the risk-benefit ratio of continuous internal monitoring is negative for most women.
I think you could safely say that, yes. And there are many people who would agree, but they, for liability reasons, won't change the modus operandi.
Only got about a minute. I know I'd like to keep asking you some questions, but I'd like you to have the opportunity just to sum up the key points you want people to remember.
Well, in our book, Our Bodies, Ourselves, Pregnancy and Birth, we really ask a lot of good questions about where your value system lies. We also point out who is more likely as a caregiver to lead to more unnecessary medical interventions. And as a class of providers, that's not true of everyone in the provider group, midwives do the best there. But if you have a complicated pregnancy and birth, you want to have somebody who's skilled and is experienced with that complication with your high-risk situation. So in some cases, co-management is a great idea, or you need an obstetrician. Choose your place wisely. Read about people's varying experiences. And know to get good continuous labor support, whether it's a doula, a midwife. Make sure you've got that good support. Sometimes a family member can give it, but very often family members are so emotionally involved they aren't the best people to give you that kind of support you need. But most of all, don't be filled with fear and doubt. Think about birth in positive ways. Read about the fact that the vast majority of births are uncomplicated, go well, and that you can have a good outcome even if something doesn't go the way you want it.
Thanks, Judy, for all you've done. This has been wonderful. We'll be back next week at 2 o'clock on May 11th, and we'll be talking about some recent research in Anchorage. So for KSKA and for Line One, this is Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.